Okay, cool. So this session will run as the others have. We'll have an introduction and then we'll have time for discussion. Presenting the case for why sexism, why modern society is so sexist. why sexism exists in modern society, either way, is going to be Jade Eckhouse. Jade is a socialist here in Melbourne. She's based at Melbourne University and she's done lots of research into the topics of oppression and sexism in particular. So please make her welcome.
Well, I wanted to start actually by referencing something that someone said in one of the sessions, one of the first sessions I went to at this conference. I think probably a lot of people in this room might have been there. The Marxist 101 session that was about, how do you create change within the system, or can you create change within the system? And a woman got up in that session, I thought, perfectly encapsulated what our attitude to that question should be, but to this question as well. And she said, do you feel angry? Like, do you feel angry about this? Because I feel angry about this. And I think that we live in a society where we are constantly told that we should not feel angry about the injustices that exist in our society, about the way we're treated, about how we're belittled, and about how our lives are so often, big aspects of them are outside of our control. Clearly, the world we live in today, sexism is a constant issue of discussion all throughout society and all throughout the media. And I think there's constantly all these different examples that are brought to bear, cases that are put forward to argue that sexism really is not that bad, it's not that prevalent, it's not a very big deal in society. Don't we know things have changed, things have fundamentally transformed? So, you watch TV, you have Disney princesses wielding weapons and fighting off bad guys, not just falling asleep for 100 years. You have trans women like Laverne Cox in Orange is the New Black or Caitlyn Jenner held up as celebrities and celebrated. And you have politicians of every stripe, including our fantastic Tony Abbott, who say they're feminists, who say that everyone in society is against sexism, and it's something that everyone wants to take a stand around. There are those things, but there are also clearly genuine changes that have been won in the system we live under. Just 50 years ago, women in Australia couldn't open their own bank accounts. You weren't able, if you worked in the public services, to continue working after you were married. One strange fact I found out is a whole series of bars in Australia. Bars used to be segregated. In Brisbane, the last bar was only desegregated in the 70s. So segregation meant that women and men could not drink in the same bar together. Women were not allowed to drink in the front section of the bar. There was a whole series of women during the women's liberation struggle that staged a form of protest that I myself like to stage sometimes, sitting in the front of the bar and having a drink. It's clearly a lot more radical back when they were involved in it. Clearly, though, there's a disjunct between the things that seem like they've changed or the representations we see in the media of different ways that women can live their lives and the experience of the vast majority of women. So, of the people who live in poverty around the world, 70% of those people are women. Women in Australia, it's been decades now since women legally won equal pay, but still are paid 18 to 19% less than men. And all throughout the world, for women who suffer from another form of oppression, the pay gap can be even larger. So like in the US, Hispanic women are paid on average 35% less than men. In Australia, we've clearly seen constant attacks on women and women's living standards. In Australia, there's a shortfall. They did this survey in 2007, and have not repeated it again. In 2007, there was a shortfall of over 100,000 funded childcare spaces for women to be able to leave their leave their children when they go to work or when they go out. The year after that, the government closed down 50 childcare places across Australia, so you would expect that gap would be even larger. So women are still forced into doing domestic duties, looking after children, taking time off work, not necessarily because that's what they decide to do, but because we're given very few other options. In Australia, the question of abortion rights is clearly still a real issue. People would know that in Tasmania, the only abortion rights clinic in Tasmania has just been closed down. So even if you can legally access an abortion, unless you have the financial capability, time, effort and energy able to travel across state lines, that's not a reality. And even in places where there still are abortion clinics, for a lot of women, having to pay the often hundreds and hundreds of dollars that is necessary just to have basic control over your own body is not a possibility. Clearly as well, for all different groups of women who exist in Australia, society is not getting better. For Aboriginal women, who have to live with not just the history, but the ongoing reality of the stolen generation. For refugee women, who are locked up in detention centres and concentration camps run by the Australian government, who often have to go through the belittling and humiliating process of having to bed guards for things like pads and tampons, or for Muslim women who are constantly harassed by groups like ASIO and the police. We can see that society has not fundamentally transformed to be some bastion of liberation for women either all around the world or in Australia. The sexualised images which objectify women as sex objects are everywhere in society, from porn to the mainstream media to TV and movies. And often, like, you watch these things, like, you know, they all seem like they're the same. You know, you watch a movie, seems almost exactly the same as some porno. And you get a glimpse of the consequences that those belittling and humiliating images of women have in the stories that have kind of come flooding out as part of the Me Too hashtag. And so that was a hashtag people would know that was originally driven by the allegations and stories of abuse and of rape carried out by some of the most rich and powerful people in America, the top echelons of Hollywood, you know, some of the most famous producers and actors. And I think that you know, the way they behave has really revealed not just kind of the horrible way that women are treated, but a whole mentality that pervades a particular section of society, that pervades the section of society who run an organised society, about the absolute disdain they have for people who they see as being their underlings. And I think a lot of those stories have resonated with women, not necessarily because it's every single woman's experience of her life, because it reflects, reinforces, and you know, kind of is often mirrored in you know, a whole series of women experiences that women have in our lives. So, you know, most women who work in the hospitality or in any services sector will have come under pressure from her boss to dress a certain way, to wear makeup, and to not arc up when people at work treat you like you're a sex object. But Me Too, I think, yeah, really has also revealed the really repulsive predatory attitude that the people who run an organised society have towards the rest of us. And I think it's kind of best exemplified, or first exemplified, in the first thing that broke open the Me Too scandal, the scandal about Harvey Weinstein. This multi-billionaire who runs the Weinstein Company, or ran the Weinstein Company, as his own personal fiefdom, where he didn't just rape and abuse women, but where he used his position as one of the, you know, richest people, incredibly wealthy person in America, to destroy other people's lives, to belittle people, to abuse people, to beat people, and to organise society in such a way that he found to be useful. Harvey Weinstein in 2016, when it came out that there were journalists and women who were going to leak and promote stories about what he'd actually done, he actually contracted two corporate espionage organisations. One was called Kroll, which is one of the biggest ones that exists. The other one that I think a lot of people might have heard of is called Black Cube. And Black Cube is actually run by ex-Mossad agents from the Israeli army who advertise themselves as having, you know, battle-hardened Mossad agents who will, for the highest bidder, you know, dig up whatever dirt you want. I think the fact that these organisations exist, like, it's quite shocking. These groups are not, you know, kind of generally, it seems, used just to try and silence and cover over allegations of rape and sexual assault, but are used to dig up dirt on people, the people that bosses might want to fire, or to dig up corporate espionage so that particular companies can get ahead and help capitalists spy on different individuals. Clearly as well, the scandal people would have seen of the President's Club reveals that this is not just some question about the attitude you know, the people, the richest and most powerful people in Hollywood have towards women, you know, an industry that's clearly intensely sexist. But the President's Club, you saw the meeting up of some of the richest, like the who's who of the British and European capitalist class, along with a whole series of their political representatives, who met up together ostensibly to raise money for charity, but to actually bully, harass, abuse and belittle the women who were employed as waitresses to work there. I think one of the other reasons that Me Too has struck a chord with people is because it's revealed a thing that I think a lot of people think and know about the world and sometimes kind of struggle to put into words, but the absolute hypocrisy of the liberal establishment. And I think that is really well exemplified by one of my most hated people in the world, Lena Dunham. Do people here know who Lena Dunham is? Yeah, general nodding, some kissing, little head shake from the front row. Lena Dunham is a person who has, she is a multi-billionaire who has made her a career as being the who's who of liberal feminism. She is her very popular show, Girls. It's a show that's about how raunchy culture has liberated women, society has transformed, and if only there were more women like her in the world, this would be a fundamentally better place. In the aftermath of the Weinstein scandal, she wrote an article, and in the article she said that what happened with Weinstein has to be a wake-up call to men in Hollywood and to men more generally about their attitudes and behaviour. She also said in that article that she was perfectly aware of all the allegations that had been raised about Harvey Weinstein, but she had decided to not just do nothing, but to continue to work with him, A, because she thought it'd be good for her career, but secondly, she decided to continue to work with him because she was, at the time, promoting a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton, that she wanted him to co-organise with her, which he did. And I think for someone like Lena Dunham to say, the people who need to learn a lesson about this are men all around the world, you know, every man in this room who clearly was responsible for Harvey Weinstein's behaviour, not people like her, some of the richest and most powerful people in society who helped cover up his behaviour and his crimes for decades and decades, is not just an outrage, but it does reflect an argument I think is always made about who is responsible for sexism. I think, though, it's not just the most gratuitous forms of sexism that we need to oppose. In the society that we live in, women, I think, always have to straddle a complex and often contradictory set of expectations and roles that relate to our assigned gender and our assigned sexualities. And adequately performing those roles is often like this lifelong task, which involves a lot of pain, humiliation, you know, learning the boundaries of what is or is not acceptable. It's the process of learning those lifelong roles that encourages women to be docile, to be silent, not to arc up, that teaches women how we should behave, but also teaches both men and women how it is that they should behave towards women and how it's acceptable to treat women. So as John Lennon said, and you know, began in his kind of beautiful ballad, Working Class Hero, he said, as soon as you're born, they make you feel small. And there's lots of groups in our society that are made to feel more small. And through that process, the process of being made to feel small, whether you're a woman, you know, a migrant, a refugee, an Indigenous woman, through that process, people are made to feel less confident to arc up and to demand a decent life. And insofar as other people, you know, the mass of exploited people, the mass of the working class, accept those ideas that are put forward and that are argued, insofar as they accept them, it makes it more difficult to organise a genuine fight back against people who exploit us. Often the way I think sexism is talked about is it's just about ideas. You know, people have bad ideas in their head. These correspond with bad stereotypes that exist in society. And if only we could transform and change those bad ideas, we'd be able to fundamentally transform the society we live in. But I think in a more realistic way, those ideas exist, are able to take hold, are able to continue to exist, because they both reflect and reinforce a reality that exists in society. And that reality is not just that people treat each other in an unequal fashion or women feel that they're unequal. That reality is that women are unequal. So what are the ideas that are used to justify that? I think one of the very popular ideas that's advanced by the right is that there are just natural, innate, biological differences between men and women. There's something about women that predisposes us maybe to like cleaning or enjoy pink things, to see a screaming baby and to think, oh, I'd love to hold that forever. I can't wait for it to vomit on me. And there's something that's totally different about men that fits them more to math, science, engage in politics, maybe enjoy a bit of rough and tumble and hard manual labour. In 2015, there was this big study that a whole series of neurologists did, which was about trying to map men and women's brains to figure out what the differences between them were and to you know, advance an argument that there's something innate about female brains as opposed to male brains. And they did the study again and again and again because they couldn't quite get the results they wanted. So in all the studies they did, they found that 90 to 100% of these brains didn't fit into what they had decided would be the male and female brains. So 90 to 100%, that's everyone. Especially considering that they said in their study that they thought they could be like a 7% correct for statistical anomalies. So maybe 107% of people's brains do not fit into what scientists think maybe a woman and a man's brain might look like. So gender and sexuality and the way that people are socialised is not simply a product of biology. The norms that we kind of come to expect, the way we relate to each other, I think all of those things are things that have been socialised. And one of the key institutions that's used to socialise people, to inculcate people into the correct ways to behave is the family. The family, like growing up in a family with a mum and dad, you know, maybe some siblings, a dog, whatever, is clearly something that to most people just seems natural, normal, the way you've always lived, you know, what other possibilities are there. But I think every institution that exists under capitalism is fashioned around a logic that exists in the system. So the logic of the system we live under is a logic of profit and exploitation. You can kind of think about it in other ways. Clearly, there's a whole series of other institutions that exist under capitalism, none of which are particularly natural, but seem to us that they are, and then shape us, not just when we're interacting with them, but in every other aspect of our lives. So you think about like corporations, that's not natural. That's just, you know, big corporations are creative institutions that then infect every single part of your life. So when you're waiting at the train stop, feeling frantic when you're on your way to work, and you realise the train's going to be 5 minutes late, and then you're going to be 5 minutes late to work, and like this is going to be a drama, and maybe you'll get fired. There's this unnatural institution which is determined the whole way you see and perceive yourself, how you move through space and time, what your priorities are, and how you organise your life. And the family couldn't exist outside of that bubble. There's no institution that could exist under capitalism that could exist as some free-floating entity where people are able to actually have liberated experiences, interact with each other as equals, you know, not feel oppressed or marginalised, etc. Clearly, I think there's a couple of things about the family. Firstly, clearly family is one of the first places where, just in terms of sexist gender norms, it's where people learn sexist gender norms. And, like, you see that in the weirdest ways. Like, you know, people's obsession with gender is, like, it's a pretty high level of intensity. People take little bald babies and put, like, pink headbands on them to show that they're girls. Like, it's literally like throwing a bangle on a potato. But it reflects how obsessed people are already as soon as a child is born with the idea of gender, with the importance that that allocates to how they interact with that, you know, new person, and how they expect that person to interact with them. So, you know, there's a million different studies that show that. One of my favourite ones is about the thing about how people hold babies, that people hold and interact with babies based totally differently based on whether they're a boy or a girl. So, you know, girl babies get rocked gently, boy babies get bounced, boy babies get talked to loudly, girl babies get cooed at, you know, and, like, you know, little sounds made at them. And clearly, people don't do that in a self-conscious way. They're not like, oh, it is a girl, like, goo, 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 goo. Like, it's that is what, it reflects people's pre-existing understanding of the world and how society functions. Clearly, though, the family, though, is not just a place where people learn about sexist gender norms. I think the family is an important ideological and economic institution under capitalism. Clearly, it's an important economic institution because it's where a whole range of labour, which in no logical society would just be marginalised to, you know, a small group who happen to produce the biological material to create a baby, where a whole range of labour is just isolated and is done. So, you know, the kind of all the things I said before about massive shortfall in childcare places. So the care for children, also for the sick and the elderly, but the care for children is something that is exclusively done within the home by the family. And overwhelmingly, it's done by women. There was a study in 2015 that showed there's only 19% of women who are were currently staying at home with their children who, if they were able to return to work, so if they were able to have access to childcare, if their jobs were highly paid enough to mean that they could afford to pay for childcare, would still continue to be in the home. Clearly as well, the family is an important ideological institution because it doesn't just socialise us into gender roles. I think it's the first kind of institution you interact with that socialises you into a real understanding of the world. So you grow up in a family, you grow up with the expectation that your life, your circumstances, whether you are well off, live somewhere nice, go to a good school, etc., that all of that is determined by just the situation that you're born into. And that improving that, making it better, is the responsibility just of you and of a couple of other people who you happen to know, happen to be friends with, happen to be, you know, the child of. So it's one of the first kind of interactions we have in the world where we're taught that we're isolated, atomised, alone. The only thing we can do to try and get ahead is to just push ourselves forward. And then we have all these other institutions that then reinforce and back that up, I think, all throughout people's lives. I think as well, a lot of the hysterias that clearly are, like, sexist hysterias that are whipped up by the right, they're broader than that. So think about things like, you know, single parents, specifically single mothers, ongoing hysteria in society, to outrage, all these single mothers weren't, you know, good enough women to keep, you know, their husbands at home. But no one cares about rich single mothers. Like, Gina Reinhart is a single mother. No one thinks it's appalling that Gina Reinhart is a single mother. And so when people go on rampages about the repulsive reality of all these single mothers, it's not just a sexist hysteria. It clearly is using sexism to justify all the ideas that already exist in society, which is people who need welfare or extra help from society, you know, who want to demand, you know, maternity leave, whatever else. Oh, well, those people are just drains on the system. They're no good, etc. The burdens placed on women and working class families represent only massive gains for the capitalist class. So there's now, it was last count, it was like $8 trillion that are hidden offshore in private bank accounts. And in any society that was based around logic, providing for the vast majority of people, meeting people's human needs. You could take that $8 trillion and provide for free childcare, housing, food for everyone in society, as opposed to just the reality that exists today, which is it's the expectation that women will provide all of those services. I think another common idea about what holds us back in our fight for sexual liberation is the idea that it's just outdated ideas of like troglodytes from the 1950s, old white men who have outdated ideas and understandings of society, and when they finally die off, we'll be able to fundamentally transform society. Well, I think there's a couple of things to say about that. I think the first thing is that clearly for a lot of people, I think the American elections was a big wake-up call to that idea, because clearly that idea fits in with a more broad right-wing idea, which is just, oh, well, society is just gradually getting better. If we sit back and wait for outdated ideas to die out, then we'll have a fundamental transformation in the society we live in. But seeing a battle between two of the most well-hated and obnoxious capitalists that America was able to find, I think has kind of checked that idea for a whole series of people. Clearly, society is not gradually getting better. There's a battle that's going on in society. That battle is sometimes around questions of gender and sexuality, but more broadly, a battle between left and right, which will determine whether or not society gets better or society doesn't. I think the second thing that backs up that point is actually in survey after survey shows that the people who have the worst ideas about gender and sexuality, and specifically about interpersonal sexism, are not all the old people who we're meant to hate. It's young people, it's me, and it's all of you. It's people aged between 18 and 30 who, on average, have the worst positions around the questions of interpersonal sexism. The people who have the best, or the time that there was the best positions around the questions of interpersonal sexism, was in the early and mid-80s. So coming out of a period of mass upheaval and social struggle, talking a lot at this conference about the 60s, the gay liberation movement, the women's liberation movement, the radicalizations that happened across society, which threw ideas up in the air, where people used as an opportunity to surge forward, to demand their rights. Those are the things that push back and transformed people's ideas, not just the slow and steady march of history. So why is that? I think it's because sexual oppression comes from institutions built into the system of capitalism. And it's a system clearly that's produced the greatest inequality that we've ever seen, and a system that organises its entire logic around the logic of profit and demands the exploitation of the vast majority of people. So through a process of wage theft, keeps most people oppressed and fucked over and enriches a tiny minority of people. In Australia, women make up just over 50% of the workforce, and companies clearly depend both on them working and on being able to underpay them to continue to make super profits. I talked before about the wage gap, but for women who are graduates, like university graduates, women will earn on average $1.5 million less than men over the course of our lifetimes. So what causes that disparity? Sexual stereotypes mean bosses expect women to do certain jobs and not others, and clearly has influence over what women study, what we see our interests as being, and the industries that women are most located in are often some of the most lowly paid industries. The demands on women to look after children and to do work in the home means that around 50% of women who work in Australia work in casualised or part-time work. Then we get told by the media, oh, well, the reason why women earn less than men is because women have made all these choices. They've chosen to go into a particular industry. You've chosen to look after children. But what choice is it when you have no other options, when there's no childcare, where your whole life and world is determined around, socialised and sexualised behaviours. In the US, women make up 75% of the 10 lowest wage occupations, with nearly half of those people who are in those occupations being women of colour. And it's the exact same reality in Australia. So, like, cleaning is the perfect example. Industrial cleaning has nothing to do with the, like, house cleaning you might do around your home, like working with chemicals, carrying heavy things around. These are the things that are normally thought of as being the stereotypes of what men do with their lives. But the sexist stereotypes about women in the home, cleaning, nurturing, looking after, picking things up, are used to justify paying those women lower wages. That workforce is also overwhelmingly migrant. So the fact that women come to Australia, maybe don't necessarily speak the language, and are not given language classes clearly by the Australian government, can maybe not know about the unions that might exist, etc., are a way that cycle continues to be created. So for the capitalists, there's a necessity that people do shit low-wage jobs. Clearly, in a society that was organised in any way logically, you might say, okay, there's a lot of shit jobs that sometimes need to be done. Everyone will do a little bit of it, or everyone in the world is so obsessed with automation, maybe we'll get the robots to clean, we'll figure out a way around this. Instead, they come up with and organise a system which pushes people into certain jobs and then creates a political justification for it that, oh, well, you know, it just makes sense that these women work these shit jobs and get very little in return for it. Clearly as well, there's a whole series of industries that women are located in which are not exactly like, you know, things like cleaning, but were industries that were previously well-paid industries, respected industries. But once you see masses of women entering those industries, you see the whole, both ideological understanding of them, but the whole structure of those industries change. And so teaching is probably the perfect example, previously a fairly well-paid, male-dominated industry. When you saw the mass entry of women into the industry, now teaching is no longer about you're a genius teaching the next generation, creating the morals of society. Now teaching is thought of, it's touchy-feely, it's about raising, you know, sweet minds, nurturing people, looking after people. And clearly, that ideological shift has come along with and been part of backing up a whole reality which has been about proletarianising teaching, meaning making the hours that you teach a lot longer, the job more repetitive, taking away control in the industry, etc. And we've clearly seen a whole series of campaigns around that. You know, I think a lot of people in this room might have been along to the Big Steps rallies that happened over the last week around Australia, where early childhood educators, the majority of whom are women, are fighting for their rights for equal pay. And I think all of that shows that women as a group do not have some interest in transforming capitalist society, in changing the world, and in reshaping a society where we can all have equal sexual liberation. Quite clearly, women capitalists benefit from the reality that they can pay their workers lower wages, and women politicians, people like Hillary Clinton, might like to use the rhetoric of sexism to explain her loss or to argue why you should vote for her, but have no interest in transforming society to meet the mass of ordinary women's needs. One of my most hated women politicians is Madeleine Albright. Who knows who Madeleine Albright is? Some people? Yeah. Two hands. Do it all together or not at all. Madeleine Albright was the first female Secretary of State in the US. She was responsible as the Secretary of State for killing over 2 million people in Afghanistan. She was also responsible for the sanctions in Iraq, which saw 500,000 Iraqi children die in Iraq. When she was asked, do you think that was too harsh? She said, we think the ends benefit the means. We think it was fine. Madeleine Albright, incidentally, she's just put out a new book she's written. It's about fascism in the 21st century, which potentially might be a memoir. Compare that, counterpose that to last year, I was in Melbourne at a demonstration of 10,000 construction workers who are marching for penalty rates. Penalty rates is not a question that is going to affect construction workers' lives, mostly male workers who work in an industry where their pay is not set or determined by penalty rates. Penalty rates is going to fuck over some of the most lowly paid workers in Australia and is going to hit some of the industries where a lot of women are located. So compare those two scenes. These women at the top of society who perpetuate, push forward and benefit from sexism to the demonstrations of solidarity that you see workers coming out and protesting. And I think for socialists, that fits into an argument that we always want to make. For socialists, we don't just accept the status quo, society as it exists. The argument that socialists always make, when you see 10,000 trade unionists marching for women's rights, the argument you make is that men and women linking up together, working class men and women linking up together to push forward struggle is the way forward, is the argument about how we could organise a different kind of society. I think one of the most inspiring recent examples we've just kind of seen over the last couple of weeks has been of the West Virginia teacher strike. So who in the room was at that session? I don't know. Not that many people. So in West Virginia, you saw teachers who went out, the West Virginia teachers, much like a lot of teachers, are overwhelmingly women. 3/4 of the workforce in West Virginia are teachers. They're paid thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars less than teachers who, you know, just work over the their state boundary. And they went out on strike for 9 days, organised mass demonstrations, marching to the Capitol building, occupying the Capitol building to win a wage rise for them and for a whole series of other public sector workers in West Virginia. But they saw themselves not just as taking up some issue of women's rights or women's issues, but they saw themselves as standing in a, I think, excellent, amazing legacy and history of working class struggle in their state. So anyone who watched some of the videos would have seen that all these women were wearing, well, they're wearing two things. A lot of them were wearing bunny ears and wearing red bandanas. The reason they're wearing bunny ears is because their sexist governor referred to them all as dumb bunnies. The reason they were wearing red bandanas was because the red bandana was originally the costume that mine workers, coal mine workers, in the 1920s in West Virginia wore during the Battle of Blair Mountain. And the Battle of Blair Mountain was one of the biggest strikes in American history, where tens and tens of thousands of mine workers didn't just go out on strike and just picket. They marched across Logan County while the government dropped bombs from planes on them, fighting with thugs that were organised by the mining worker, the mining bosses, to demand their right to unionise. The red bandanas was also the uniform that was worn by the striking mine workers in West Virginia in the 70s, when for over a decade they staged wildcat strikes of thousands and thousands and thousands of people, culminating in a strike from 77 to 78, where 160,000 mine workers went out on strike for 111 days to fight against the shitty pay they were given, the shitty conditions, and the fact that the companies they worked for, where they had gone down in the mine, got black lung and were slowly dying, that the companies they worked for had worked with the West Virginian political establishment to mean that they got no compensation, were just thrown on the scrap heap and weren't able to get access to anything. And I think that legacy of working class struggle that inspired the teachers in West Virginia has to be a lesson for all of us. That to undermine sexism, we need to not just kind of focus on things that might be traditionally seen as being women's women's issues or about taking up the question of women's rights, but we need to rebuild and carry forward the working class traditions of solidarity, of taking a stand. And I think those traditions, they're encapsulated in the slogans that are raised by the union movement every time workers struggle. Solidarity, touch one, touch all. The idea that the mass of ordinary people have to unite together and take a stand, and that's the way we can transform society. And I think what we need to see and what we need to think that we want to build is a movement so determined and so centred on the strength of the organised working class that the experience of that and the experience of that solidarity dominates the mass of ordinary people's lives. And that's the way we can shunt to the side the experience that dominates most people's lives today, which is of, you know, isolation, being alone, sexist belittling images of women everywhere in society. And I think that would be a basis for a fight to bring down a system that's based on oppression and exploitation and replace it with something totally different. The strength of our unity and our solidarity could be the foundation of a totally different kind of society. And I know probably a lot of people are as well, like watching all the videos of the West Virginian teachers, you know, at the rallies, organising things. One of my favourite videos is this woman, kind of like, you know, she's quite small, she's quite meek when she first came up to the camera, and she said she wanted to have something to say, you know, and the reporter said, oh, why are you out on strike? And most of the people, when they asked them why are you out on strike, they launched into a list of demands and, you know, what they've done to organise and here's what I think about the governor. She said, I've never done anything like this in my life before. I've never really thought I could do anything like this. I've always felt so small. Mm. And then she kind of stopped and she stepped back and she like looked around. She was like, but I don't feel small anymore. Mm. That's not the way I feel. Mm. So I think for us, as an argument about what kind of society we want to build, about how to fight sexism, I think that thing the woman said in the first session is right. We are right to be angry. That has to be the starting point. We are right to be angry, and we have to use that anger to try and build a world where no one has to feel small anymore.